Hey, this is Pastor Matt from Missio Dei Fellowship in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. I'm thankful that you found our sermons, and I hope that they're a way to encourage you in your walk with Christ. However, this sermon was given in the context of my local church and for those that God has entrusted to me. If you are in our area, I want to encourage you to come on a Sunday to worship with our body. And if you're not in this area, these sermons are a great tool for supplementing your walk with Christ, but no means a substitute for your local church. You need to submit yourself to a faithful Bible-teaching church and shepherd in your area. Well, please do open up your Bibles to Luke chapter 5. Luke chapter 5, and we stand to, Lord willing, finish chapter 5 this morning, which in this very strange year, we began back on December 15th. And so after many, many months, we'll, Lord willing, finish chapter 5 this morning and begin chapter 6 next week. And so we come to the end of chapter 5, and we'll pick it up in verse 33. And I have much to say to you this morning, and so just by way of introduction, I'm going to read the passage, and then we'll start working through it. So that's Luke chapter 5, and we'll be in verses 33 through the end of the chapter, verse 39. Here is what Luke, this historian, pastor, theologian, and physician by trade, writes under the inspiration of the Spirit. He says, "And they said to him, 'The disciples of John often fast and offer prayers, and the disciples of the Pharisees also do the same, but yours eat and drink.' And Jesus said to them, 'You cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you? But the days will come, and when the bridegroom is taken away from them, then they will fast in those days.' And he was also telling them a parable, saying, 'No one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and puts in an old garment. Otherwise, he will both tear the new, and the piece from the old will not, piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst, and the skins will be spilled out, and the skins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one after drinking old wine wishes for new, for he says the old is good enough.'" Well, we come to a very important passage this morning in this gospel. This is a very significant passage just on a superficial read. You might wonder what it's all about, but I tell you that it contains a very important message for us. Jesus is making something very clear. In fact, if you remember from last time, Jesus is now in a full-on confrontation with the Pharisees. And so he is engaged by this group of self-righteous religious elites. And so as he makes some statements in which he begins to draw some very deep lines now between him and the religious establishment. And he is now starting to say some things which are no longer merely raising the eyebrows of the Pharisees, but are indeed beginning to incite some rage. And so he is making some very dramatic statements. And so just to remind you of the scene a little bit, chapter 5 is essentially the beginning of Jesus calling his very first disciples. And so in verses 1 through 11, he calls Peter, James, and John to follow him. And you'll remember that he there skips over the Pharisees, that is the religious institution. He skips over the crowd, that is those neutral, half-hearted religious people who are but nominally committed. And because Judaism, the religion of Judaism, is just part of the cultural conscience of this day. And in fact, that's what the crowd, as a formal category, represents in Luke, those neutral, half-hearted religious people. And so he just skips over those people and instead goes to Peter, James, and John, and in very explicit terms commands them to follow him. And so we spent some time just talking about the nature of true discipleship, what it means to be a true follower of Jesus, what it means to leave everything as the text states and to follow him and to become a fisher of men. And so in light of this great theme of discipleship, we spent several weeks talking about it at length, and we came to three wonderful accounts that are filled with grace, filled with mercy and hope. And so we saw those accounts of the leper, the paralytic, and then of course last time, Levi the tax collector, who was just the worst of the worst, morally speaking. And so what I said is that when you put those accounts together, what you discover is that Jesus has come to redeem the helpless in the leper. He has come to forgive the sinner of his sin in the paralytic. And then he has come to make the most vile of wretch a now useful disciple in Levi the tax collector, who, as we know, and as I said, eventually becomes Matthew, the very first gospel writer. And so what I tried to show is that all three of those accounts are communicating a spiritual reality. These are not about physical healing. That is not the point. In fact, that is never the point of any of Jesus' miracles ever. Rather, the point of the miracles is always to communicate that Jesus has come, but to heal our great spiritual disease, which is this reality of sin. And so he has come to forgive the sinner of their sin, to rescue them from their greatest eternal problem. And so as we worked through the account of Levi, last time we saw that radical conversion where in the midst of his sin, he also leaves everything but to follow Jesus. And so the first thing that he does, you'll remember, is that he throws a massive party for Jesus. And so at this party, he invites again the worst of the worst, the scum, the dregs of society. And so it's at this point in which some Pharisees observing him do such a thing, namely dining and drinking with tax collectors and sinners, again, the most vile of society in their minds, these Pharisees do not approve. They do not approve. And yet instead of coming to the religious elite and all those who claim to be true followers of God, Jesus goes to those who overtly have nothing to do with God. And he spends his time eating and drinking with tax gatherers. And make no mistake on the text, this was a party. This was a party. Levi throws a joyous celebration in honor of Jesus, and because he wants all of his fellow sinners to meet this forgiver of sin. And so it is a time marked by tremendous joy. It's marked by food. It's marked by drink. And so when he is questioned by the Pharisees as to why he would do such a thing, we get that phenomenal statement of Jesus in verse 32 that he has not come to call the righteous. And again, you should understand there that he means the self-righteous. That he has not come to call the self-righteous or what society would view as good people or those who think that they're good because they follow the religious norms and practices and prescriptions. But he has come to follow or call the sinners to repentance. And so the purpose of Jesus is to save the sinner. That is why he has come. That is the one who understands themselves to be a sinner. Jesus cannot save a self-righteous person. He cannot save a person who thinks that salvation comes through religious works or religious activity. He cannot save a person who thinks that they need to contribute to their salvation or earn God's grace through a works-based system of religion. And as we're going to see this morning, this is in fact what makes Jesus' message so incredibly unique. And so the statement of the Pharisees here strikes at the cord, or at the very heart of how they understand salvation to be accomplished. In fact, remember, they were a class of people who thought that salvation is something that would come through the establishment, that is, a religious institution, through religious law-keeping, the repetition of prayers, through the giving of alms. These are a group of people who are so self-righteous that their own religious practices have blinded them to the truth of what they truly are. And so they're at a point in which they no longer understand themselves to be sinners. Or at least they understand themselves to be good people or good enough, as we're going to see, to be accepted by God, and so they wouldn't be caught dead associating with a sinner, lest they themselves somehow be corrupted by their sinful, defiled state. And so at the sight of Jesus, who, again, they know in some way possesses the power of God and is therefore coming to some celebrity status at this point in first century Palestine, these Pharisees are utterly appalled that he would associate with the outcast, that he'd associate with a leper, that he'd associate with tax gatherers, again, the dregs of society. And yet not only does he associate with the tax gatherer, but he then goes to an entire party of tax collectors, which of course not only shows the kind of person that he has come to save, namely the worst of the worst, but also to show that there is no sinner who is truly beyond repentance, that the sinner cannot somehow out-sin the grace and the mercy of God. And so it is at this point in which the Pharisees begin to amp up their questioning of Jesus. In fact, this passage, along with the following two, are essentially an inquisition that they begin on Jesus. And so this begins a section in which the Pharisees, again, the great enemy of Jesus all throughout the Gospels, are going to begin to draw near, but so that they might trap this man. And so these are the religious elite. These are the ones who think that they're somehow in favor with God, and because of their legalistic, self-righteous practices. And so over the next few sections, we're going to see this inquisition of the Pharisees. In fact, I almost titled today's sermon, Confronting Jesus, because that is exactly what these Pharisees seek to do. And that is what these next few passages are all about. And so this is a section in which these self-righteous men of religion who do not like the fact that Jesus is beginning to steal the religious spotlight are going to seek to trap him in his own words. And so this begins an incredible section in which the purposes and the work of Jesus is now going to be made all the more clear. Comes all the more to the forefront as this opposition of the Pharisees is going to give him an opportunity to now make his mission and his purposes all the more explicit. And so that is exactly what we begin to see unfold in these sections. And so today we begin the first of them in verses 33 through 39 of chapter 5. And so let's take a look at the text more closely. And so for those of you who appreciate structure, my basic outline for this morning is the accusation, verse 33. Then you have the answer, verses 34 through 35, and then the analogies, verses 36 through 39. So the accusation, verse 33, the answer, verses 34 through 35, and then the analogies, verses 36 through 39. So let's take a look at the accusation first, verse 33. Notice again, please, Luke states this. He says, "And they said to him that the disciples of John often fast and offer prayers, and the disciples of the Pharisees also do the same, but yours eat and drink." Now, what's important to understand is that this is not a, as you can imagine, genuine inquiry by the Pharisees, but rather an accusation. This is an accusation, and notice, this is not a definitive statement of some law that Jesus has somehow overtly transgressed. Rather, this is a suggestive indictment. Something, in fact, typical of the Pharisees, by the way. Their goal is always to trap Jesus, and so they're just going to be dogging his steps. In fact, they realize how much favor Jesus has now gained among the people, and so they have to be very careful as to how it is they're going to trap him. And because they have seen the miracles, they've heard the teachings along with the rest of society, and so to bring a straightforward indictment would be a political misstep from a public perspective. Furthermore, remember, Jesus at this point has already equated himself in some capacity, in some sense, with God. You'll remember in the story of the paralytic, not only does he heal the man's paralysis, but he then forgives his sin, something that only God can do. And so Jesus in that scene, which again was a very public event, as is his habit, was intentionally seeking to reveal the identity of who he truly is, that he is the fullness of God himself. And so again, he very intentionally does this publicly and deliberately in front of the Pharisees, and all for the purpose of making his divine identity known. And so the Pharisees, of course, accuse him at that point of some major blasphemy. This is a crime worthy of death under Mosaic law. You cannot claim to be God in this nation. That is a crime that is blasphemy of the highest order. And so the Pharisees despise this man. Not only is he speaking things that are forbidden, such as equating himself with God himself, but in so doing, he is now stealing away the religious spotlight from the Pharisees, which is actually what they're most frustrated about. That is their issue. He is now garnering the attention, the religious attention, and doing so in a very seemingly blasphemous way. And so what the Pharisees now seek to do is try and expose Jesus publicly for his apparent law-breaking. And because, remember, he is not merely claiming to be a prophet who it was understood that God was with, but he's actually claiming to be God himself. And so to the mind of the Pharisee, if that was the case, which they don't believe to be the case, but if that was the case, then surely he ought to be able to perfectly follow the law and the traditions. The law and the traditions. And so what they're now going to do is expose him for his inability to perfectly adhere, listen, not to Mosaic law, which is the true law of God, but to the tradition and the regulations of the Pharisees. And so the first attack is what we see here in verse 33, which is their accusation again in the form of a very suggestive indictment, which notices, again, why do the disciples of John and the Pharisees fast and pray, but yours eat and drink? Now, let me say a word here about fasting and prayers, because this is the very point at which they're seeking to accuse him. But just understand that while the Pharisees think that they're bringing up a legitimate argument here, from the eyes of God, this is a very hollow accusation. In fact, remember from my sermon on the paralytic that I traced out the history of the development of the Pharisees for you a little bit, and how they essentially began in the days of Ezra, after the nation of Israel had come out of captivity in Babylon. Remember, God had put them there as a discipline for chasing false gods, for chasing after foreign idols. And so they were conquered by the Babylonians and were placed into captivity for 70 years as a judgment and discipline of the Lord. And remember, the purpose of that, again, was to purify them of their idolatry, that is, of worshiping idols and foreign gods. And so once Israel comes out of captivity, then under the leadership of Ezra, some very serious-minded men began to develop, and they began to take the law of God very seriously. And so this was a good thing. These men were seeking to turn the nation back to faithfulness, back to Torah obedience, if you will. And so their great desire was to guard the nation from ever falling into idolatry again. That is, from chasing after foreign gods. And so in order to guard against that, we need to adhere strictly to Mosaic law. And so this group of serious-minded men would pass along their devoutness, their practices, and eventually from that succession of men began to develop the tradition of these Pharisees. And so, of course, like all things, eventually the sinfulness of man begins to creep into that and corrupt that which was intended to be pure. And so as this tradition began to develop through the generations, the Pharisees, as they began to be known at some point, took those 613 commands of Mosaic law, which you can find in Exodus through Deuteronomy, and essentially began to build rules and traditions and all these regulations around those 613 laws, and so that if you perfectly obeyed them, then in their mind, it would be impossible for you to transgress any of those 613 commands. And so what they did then was essentially build a system of religion, of religious tradition around the original 613 commands of God's law. And so in so doing, again, they thought that they could somehow ensure that the nation would never fall back into idolatry again. And so as the generations went along, it became nearly impossible to separate the tradition of the Pharisees from the law of God. It became very conflated. And so by the time of Jesus, to obey the tradition of the Pharisees in their mind was also to obey the law of God. They're essentially synonymous by this point, which also means then that to break the tradition of the Pharisees in any aspect or any area is therefore to break the law of God, again, in their mind. And so by the time of Jesus, the religious system of the Pharisees was so interwoven with the nation and interwoven with the true law of God that it was thought that the only way to attain salvation and therefore to actually be considered to be among the true people of God was to strictly adhere to this Pharisaic tradition. In other words, salvation was accomplished by following the regulations and practices of the religious institution. And so this was legalism. This was works-based righteousness, plain and simple. This was salvation through religious law-keeping. This was seeking to earn and then keep God's grace and favor through religious ritual. And so this became an incredible system of self-righteous religion. And so when it comes to verse 33, what the Pharisees are doing is pointing out a very obvious transgression of Jesus, but understand that this is not a transgression of the true law of God, but a transgression of a legalistic tradition of the Pharisees. In fact, if you didn't know, God had only required by law one fast per year. This was to be a fast on the Day of Atonement, also known as Yom Kippur, that day, that great day in which one time a year the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies and offer a sacrifice for sin on behalf of the nation. And so it was on this day and this day alone in which the nation was required by God in his law to fast. Now, this fast didn't accomplish the forgiveness of sin. The law makes that very clear. But the fast was simply meant to serve them in their grieving in meditation over the seriousness of their own sin. And so there was only one fast that was actually mandated by God in all of the Old Testament. Now, there was a handful of other fasts in the Old Testament, but all those were strictly voluntary. In other words, they were not required. They did not accomplish the forgiveness of sin. They did not somehow lessen God's anger toward the sinner. Rather, they were simply a means by which a person could spontaneously grieve and mourn and humble themselves to seek out the face of God. And so, again, these were to be done spontaneously and, generally speaking, privately. In fact, Jesus picks this up in Matthew chapter 6 when he says, "Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full, but you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face. And why? Well, so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you." And so this was to be a private and typically spontaneous act, and by which a person could, again, privately humble themselves, grieve over their sin, and mourn the fact that they were not honoring God as God. And again, it did not show to God that you were somehow more serious about him. It could not in some way manipulate God's actions or perspective toward you. It did not produce any more holiness in you or produce any more grace in your life. Rather, it was simply a built-in discipline that God had offered to his people, but it was unrequired. It was completely voluntary, and again, functioned as a means to help people reflect on the sinfulness of their own sin. And that is all that it was. And yet somewhere along the way, the tradition of the Pharisees came to see fasting for some reason as a sign of true holiness, as if fasting could somehow make you righteous before a holy God. And so under the Pharisaic tradition, and we know this from Jewish history, but they began to command, they actually commanded fasting twice a week on both Monday and Thursday. And so now instead of fasting one time a year as commanded by God, it was now a twice a week deal as prescribed by the legalism of the Pharisees. In fact, this is confirmed in Luke chapter 18 where Jesus is telling a parable. And he says in verse 9, it's a very famous parable, he says, "Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. And he said, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself, 'God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. And why will I fast twice a week?'" As if that accomplished something. And so here in Jesus' day, it was already well understood that the religion of the Pharisees mandated a twice-a-week fast, and yet thought that the religious practices, again, here this idea of fasting, somehow attained for them a righteous standing before a holy God. And so again, what you have here is simply a mixing of man-made tradition or man-made religion with what God had truly desired. And so the accusation here in verse 33 is simply an accusation that is not at all founded upon the true law of God, but upon this conflation of self-righteous religion with what God had truly said. And so in light of that, it is here where Jesus is going to now begin to expose the legalism of the Pharisees for what it is. In fact, all throughout the gospel, the Pharisees are going to be constantly attacking Jesus for his refusal to adhere to their false religion, their religion which deceives people into thinking that they're on the path to true salvation, when in fact they are trapped in a wicked system of self-righteous religion. And so just in light of that accusation, notice Jesus' answer here in verse 34. Luke records this statement of Jesus. He says, "And Jesus said to him, 'You cannot make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom is with them, can you?'" Very simple answer, very plain. And Jesus here is picking on something very well known in Jewish culture. And so again, he's talking here to some Pharisees, as well as, apparently, some disciples of John, as we see in Mark's version of the account. And by the way, some wonder why John's disciples are brought up here, and because John is typically understood not to be on the side of the Pharisees, but on the side of Jesus. Well, the answer to that is because in Luke chapter 3, after John preaches that message of repentance, remember, he gains a lot of followers, but remember, John was calling them to repent, that is, to return back to the one true God. And so remember, this was an apostate nation at this point, which means they had turned their back on God. And so John here starts to cry out this message of turning back, this message of repentance. And so many had repented, many had turned back, but what they had turned back to was not the purity of God's law alone, but to this religious system of the Pharisees, this corrupt system of this religious elite, and because it had completely taken over the nation at this point. And so remember, John ends up in prison pretty quickly after he is preaching that message of repentance, and so his disciples are then just left to sort of wander. And so if you're going to turn back to God and try to get serious about God, well, then the natural thing to do is to return to the religious establishment, right? It's sort of like in our culture when a person decides that they need to start getting serious about God. And so what they do is typically just go to the largest church that's around, or perhaps even the oldest church, because in their mind, surely God must be among those people. And so here the disciples of John turn to the establishment, the long-standing tradition. And so what they turn to is the prevailing religion of the day, which again is just this religion of the Pharisees. It is a system of repetition, it's a system of rote prayers, and a system of fasting twice a week, among many other repetitive practices. And so now even the disciples of John are caught up in this false religion. And which, by the way, just goes to show how destructive and how pervasive false systems of religion can truly be. Many people think that salvation comes through religion. They think it comes through belonging to the right institution or the right church, or perhaps by observing the prescribed sacraments and religious practices of a man-made system, despite the fact that they're nowhere found in the scriptures. And so people enter into a deceived system of religion in which they simply become guilted and oftentimes trapped, but within a religious tradition that is completely void of true salvation. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, but notice here you have both the disciples of John and the Pharisees, and so Jesus is now speaking to two groups of people, and both of whom would have been very familiar with the practices of Jewish culture. And so what Jesus does is he picks up on a cultural reality that would have been very well understood by these people, and namely this idea of rejoicing at the presence of a bridegroom. And so what he does is he now uses the picture of a wedding. Picture of a wedding, which, as you understand, is a time, hopefully, filled with joy. It is to be a time of great celebration, a time of feasting, a time of drinking. In fact, in the first century Jewish world, as I've mentioned in past, Jewish weddings lasted for the period of an entire week. And so a wedding was a wonderful time, a time for great celebration. You'd be eating the choicest of foods. You'd be drinking the finest of wine. You'd be laughing in celebration for an entire week. And so to even think about fasting at a wedding, which again was a practice typified by mourning and sorrow, that would have been very inappropriate and a little bit ridiculous. I mean, if you really wanted to fast, which again was something completely voluntary, you'd either do it the week before or the week after. And so to fast at the presence of a bridegroom, which just simply means that the bridegroom is still present among you would have been completely inappropriate and culturally ridiculous. This was not a time of gloom and mourning. This was a time for tremendous joy, a time of very loud celebration, which of course includes eating a lot of food and drinking a lot of really good wine, the best wine. In fact, we see this with Jesus' very first miracle at Cana. In fact, the point is so obvious that Jesus asks the question here with a particle in the Greek that emphatically presumes the answer of no. In other words, there is zero doubt as to the proper answer to this question. This is very obvious. Now, why does he use this example of a bridegroom? Like, what does that have to do with what these Pharisees are trying to expose? Well, again, Jesus is going to use these attacks of the Pharisees to teach on the nature of who he is and the purposes for why he has come. And so what Jesus is doing is actually picking up on an Old Testament allusion in which God's relationship to his people is expressed, but in terms of a wedding. In fact, the idea of God as a bridegroom to his people was an Old Testament image often that was pointing to the coming Messiah. We see this in Isaiah 54, Jeremiah 2, Ezekiel 16, among many others, but it was a reference, and a well-understood reference, that God was going to be a bridegroom to his people, which meant then that he was to be physically among them, but he'd be among them in the form of his Messiah. And so what Jesus is doing is picking up on this imagery that, again, would have been well-known, and especially by the Pharisees, to indicate that the Messiah is now among them. And so on the question of fasting, Jesus essentially flips the script on these people in the form of a question by saying that when the bridegroom comes, which again is a clear reference to the Messiah based on the Old Testament, it would not be a time of mourning and gloom, but of intense celebration. And so as is his habit, notice he masterfully flips the script here, but as if to say, listen, the Messiah has come, and so the real question here is, so why don't you, Pharisees, drink? Translation, I am the Messiah, and you do not recognize this. And, by the way, neither do your disciples. And so my disciples eat and drink, and why? Well, because they recognize that the Messiah has come, and the Messiah is me. By the way, you see that Jesus says nothing here about prayers. That is, presumably he does not agree that his disciples do not pray. Rather, they simply refuse to engage in a kind of rote, repetitious, heartless set of prayers that the Pharisees had prescribed, as if repetition of many prayers could somehow rescue the sinner. And so his disciples indeed did pray, but they just refused to pray the repetitive, faithless prayers of the Pharisaic institution. And so what's important to understand is that Jesus takes this opportunity here to once again make his identity known. That is the point. He is the Christ. He is the Messiah. And so this is not a time to fast and mourn, but this is a time to eat and to drink and to celebrate. And again, why? Well, because the bridegroom of God is among them. He is present with them. And so the true disciples of Christ enter into a time of tremendous joy, as we saw typified by this man named Levi. Jesus spent much time eating very good food, drinking very good wine, and again, because the bridegroom was with his people. This is celebration. But then in verse 35, notice, Jesus makes an immediate contrast. He says, but the days will come, and when the bridegroom is taken away, literally snatched away from them, then they will fast in those days. Now, the point here is clear enough, but the interpretational question is, to what time period is this referring? And I don't have the time to work through the various arguments for you, but suffice it to say that it's best to see this as a reference to the time between his death and the time in which he returns before he ascends back or into heaven. In fact, the term here that's translated as taken away is the term apeiro. It's a very aggressive term in the Greek and often indicates violence. And so it's a pretty clear reference to his death. In fact, he would not use this term to speak of his ascension. And so it'd be very difficult to conclude that this is speaking somehow of his post-ascension or the time of the church, which is the time that we're right now in. And so it's best to understand it as the time immediately after his death, when all of his disciples are living in immense horror at the fact that the one whom they thought was the Messiah has just been brutally executed and ripped from their midst. And so no doubt they would have been mourning and fasting and experiencing some tremendous grief in those days immediately following his death, which of course is exactly what's recorded for us in the Gospels. And so what I think that Jesus means here in verse 35 is that a day is coming in which he's going to be violently removed from the disciples' presence and very much against their own will. And so it'll be a time in which fasting will be very appropriate. It will be a time filled with incredible sorrow and grief and pain. But for now, as Jesus says, the bridegroom is still among them. He is still among them. And so he says to the disciples here, the Pharisees and of John, that this is a time of deep, deep celebration. This is a time of joy. This is a time of merriment where it is exceedingly appropriate to both eat and drink. Just a foreshadow of heaven's eternal celebration. Now again, these series of confrontations by the Pharisees are going to give Jesus some ample opportunity now to clarify what he is all about, that is, why he has come, what his purposes are. And so in verses 36 through 39, we see three analogies. And so the three pictures, three analogies in which Jesus is now going to clarify the absolute incompatibility of his message with the message of the Pharisees, which of course is going to explain why him and his disciples are so dramatically different than the religion of the day. And so I'm just going to work through these rather quickly because all three have the exact same meaning. And so he's just driving home the point with the repetition. But notice in verse 26, he gives the first of these analogies. Luke says, "And he, Jesus, was also telling them a parable. No one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and puts it in an old garment. Otherwise, he will both tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old." Now, the point is simple, not a lot of mystery, not a lot of complexity, and anyone who's done any kind of repairing of clothes or cloth material understands the point. But the point is that to try and stitch new or you could say unshrunk material, as both Matthew and Mark recorded in their account, but to stitch some unshrunk material onto some old or shrunken material will only result in the new material tearing away from the old once it becomes shrunk, and presumably once you wash the material. And so the point is that the new or unshrunk material is going to fail to adequately repair the failures of the old material. And so he says that you cannot patch together two different materials and expect to accomplish your purposes. Well, in the same way, his point here is to say that you cannot patch my message onto your message. That is, you cannot patch your dead religion of Pharisaic principles onto the true law of God and expect for it somehow to result in salvation for you. That is not how this works. I have come with a completely different message. I am not trying to fit my message into your message. In fact, you must abandon your approach to salvation entirely if my new message is to have any kind of saving power for you. And by the way, he uses the word new in this passage seven times, as if to emphatically make the point that his method and his message and his way of salvation is something now completely unique. And so you cannot mix the exclusivity of his message with any message. Which, of course, strikes an extreme blow against any person who tries to claim that there are multiple ways to God. Over and over again throughout the gospel, there is but one exclusive path to salvation, and that is the emphatic point that he wants us to understand. There is one way, one means, one method, and so to try and stitch his message onto a different system will only ensure that you destroy everything. And notice as well, verse 37, he gives another parable, but again, just to make the same point, he says, "And no one puts new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled out, and the skins will be ruined. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins." And so in first century Palestine, if you didn't know, the way that you'd preserve wine is that you'd essentially take a goat or a sheep, you'd cut out the insides, and then you'd use the skin of the body as a container or a vessel for the wine, where the neck portion would essentially become the spout. Aren't you glad for plastic? And so they'd remove all the hair, they'd treat the skin so that it could become supple, and then they'd pour in the new wine. Well, of course, as the new wine would ferment, it would release these gases, which would then expand the skin outward. And so if you're going to preserve some new wine, then you'd have to make certain that you poured it into some new wine skins. And because if you didn't, then as you can imagine, as the skin, or as you pour that, as the skin would become drier over time and it would become less supple, if you try to now put new wine with its expanding gases into some old wine skin, it's going to crack that skin and burst out all over the place. And so with the parable of Jesus here, again, he is saying that you think that I have come to give a message that will somehow fit within your old system. That is what you think. But what is vital to understand is that my message is not compatible with any system of self-righteous, merit-based religion. In fact, not only is Jesus saying that his message and his way of salvation is completely incompatible with any form of religion, but if you somehow try to work that religion into his exclusive message of salvation, then it'll completely corrupt that message and void it as utterly ineffective. And that is an eternally critical distinction. Like the difference between heaven and hell. In other words, his method is the singular means of salvation, and it can and will save the sinner. That is a promise. But listen, to try to hold to anything other or even along with the purity of his method and his gospel alone is to utterly corrupt the efficacy of his gospel to now save you. And this is so important. This is so vital to understand. And so what is Jesus' method? That is the all-important question. What is this message that Jesus brings and for which he claims to be the true path to salvation? A message that evidently cannot be mixed, cannot be corrupted, cannot be packaged or used in conjunction in any way with any religious system or effort of man. Well, it is nothing different than what we've been seeing in chapter 5 so far. In fact, it is the essence of chapter 5, and that is that the gospel of Jesus Christ, and remember the word gospel is simply a word that means good news, but the gospel of Jesus Christ is that Jesus has come to seek and to save the lost. He's come to save the sinners from their sin. He has come to rescue and redeem the most vile wretch of a sinner among us, which again is what makes the good news such good news. But as we saw in chapter 5, there is a prerequisite to coming to Jesus and receiving his forgiveness. There is a prerequisite. And that is, and we saw it with the leper, but the sinner must come to Jesus very desperate. He must come very broken. He must come in humility. He must come aware of his sin, and he must come realizing that there is absolutely nothing that he can do to earn God's grace or solve his problem of sin. There's nothing that he can do. And so this is how a person must come to Jesus. Again, we saw this exemplified with the leper. There was absolutely nothing that he could do to solve his own disease. He needed the healing of a physician. He needed someone outside of him to make him pure again. And so the person who comes to Jesus to receive his forgiveness must be a person who is deeply aware of their own sin and the wretchedness of his own unrighteous state. That is the prerequisite. They must come to Jesus, and they must bring all of their sin with them. In fact, as I said before, if you don't bring your sin with you, then what is there for him to forgive? In fact, you remember from last time that we saw how there is only one kind of person that Jesus cannot save, and that is that he cannot save a person who is self-righteous. He cannot save a self-righteous person. That is, he cannot save a person who thinks that they are good or perhaps good enough, as we'll see in verse 39. He cannot save a person who does not understand or agree with Jesus' own words as to the severity of their own predicament, and that they stand before a holy and righteous God who is, listen, perfectly just, perfectly holy, and cannot have even the slightest stain of sin in his presence. And so the problem that all of us face is that every single one of us are sinners, but to the very core. And perhaps you think that you're not all that bad. Perhaps you think that your situation is not all that desperate. Perhaps you can point to others who are far worse than you. And so what is the big deal? Well, the big deal is the fact that if you can even think that way, then that just goes to show how much you don't yet understand the depravity of your own sin. In fact, this is the essence of how a good Pharisee thought about himself. They always thought that they were good or good enough. Again, I quote for you Luke chapter 18 when Jesus tells this parable in verse 9. In fact, turn there if you can quickly. I think it's important for you to see it. Luke chapter 18. And again, I remind you that what makes Jesus' message unique is that he has not come to call the righteous or those who think that they're good enough, either religiously or morally or culturally, but he has come to call the sinner. That is, those who see and understand the depravity of their own sin. And so Luke 18, he writes in verse 9, and he, Jesus, also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt, meaning again that they kept comparing themselves to others who they thought were worse off than them. And so Jesus says, two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector, again, the worst of the worst. And the Pharisee stood and was praying this to himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector, for I fast twice a week and I pay tithes of all that I get. So he is very gifted at religion. And he is trusting in his moral superiority and religious activity to save him. Verse 13. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Why would he pray that? Why would he pray that? Why would he not look to his deeds? Or go to the temple and offer sacrifice or pay off his tithes? Well, because he understood exactly what he was. He understood the depths of his sin. He was depraved. In his sin, he was estranged from his maker, his creator, and refused to bank on the religious system to save him, because the religious system, which again is a system of good works, could not save, but just further condemn. And so he understood himself to be exactly who he was, a very desperate sinner. Verse 14, so I tell you, this is Jesus talking, I tell you, this man that is this sinner went down to his house, listen, justified. He went down justified rather than the other, the Pharisee. And why? Well, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself, that is he who knows that he is a sinner and that there is nothing in and of himself to solve his problem, he, that is the sinner, will be exalted. And this is a promise. This is a promise. The sinner will be exalted, which in the context means that he will be rescued. He'll be redeemed. He'll be forgiven. And so what is the prerequisite to coming to Jesus and having all of your sin forgiven? Well, it's that, listen, you must first understand yourself to be a very desperate sinner. And in need of complete and total rescue. No amount of religious activity or good work that you perform will ever redeem your guilt before a holy God. And so you realize that you need the perfect righteous work of another, someone outside of you, to rescue you. Which is why Jesus is so important to us, is he not? He is so important. And because he did not come because he wanted to be impressed with our good works or our religion. Rather, he came because he knew that there was nothing that we could do about it. And so in his perfection, he did it for us. So he came and lived a perfect life on our behalf. He perfectly fulfilled the law of God in absolute obedience, but on our behalf. And so listen, you are saved by good works. You are saved by good works. It's just not your good works that save you. It's his. He hung on that cross and took the full penalty of sin. But on our behalf, God is 100% just, and so he cannot let sin go unpunished. And so your sin needs to be dealt with, but the good news is that he has dealt with it for us at the cross, in his body, and on our behalf. He is our substitute. And 3 days later, he rose from the grave, which of course is the proof that God accepted him as a perfect sacrifice on our behalf. And so all throughout the scriptures, the only appropriate response to the work of Jesus, which is nothing but pure, undeserved, unmerited grace, but the only appropriate response is to trust in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus by faith and faith alone. Faith alone. But the moment that we seek to contribute to that salvation in any way, whether it be religious ritual or even trying to clean yourself up before you come to Jesus, simply nullifies his saving work on your behalf. It is Jesus Christ alone that saves, and so Jesus plus anything corrupts his gospel. You break those skins. The gospel of Jesus Christ is that he calls sinners to come to him with the fullness of their sin strapped to their back, and then to trust by faith alone in his finished work alone. In fact, in verse 33, this is exactly why he says that new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. Fresh wineskins. What does that mean? Well, the point is that you cannot take his very exclusive message of sin forgiveness, which again comes by faith alone and the work of Christ alone, but then try to fit it into a religious system. In fact, this is why so many religious systems do not save. They do not save, and hear me well on this, they only condemn you. They only condemn. Doesn't matter if it's the iconoclasm of Eastern Orthodoxy as you pray to your patron saints, or the sacramentalism of Roman Catholicism, or even the sacrificial system and Sabbatarianism of Orthodox Judaism. All of these systems of religion seek to add to the work of Christ alone, and so they're old wineskins of religion trying to preserve the fresh wine of the gospel, and you can't do it. You cannot do it. And I get a little bit exercised about it because it's not just that adding to a religious devout system won't make the gospel work, but rather it's that any religious system is also actively opposed to the efficacy or the effectiveness of the gospel to save you. It is actively opposed. And so what you have are billions upon billions of people throughout the centuries who might believe in some way that Jesus has died on the cross for their sins in some vague way. But the moment that they seek to add his work to their own religious effort, it not only corrupts the purity of the gospel, but they're now trapped inside of a false system in which, while they think that they're safe, sit condemned. And in fact, is why Jesus was so relentless with the false religious system of the Pharisees. It was a corrupt system that trapped and condemned. While they thought they were the people of God and obeying the law of God, seeking to please him, they were leading themselves and thousands to hell. And today is no different. In fact, that is the point of the entire passage. Singular message of the passage is to communicate that Jesus has not come to fit in with other religions or other practices or efforts to reach salvation, but he has come to bring something entirely new. And any attempt to fit him into a system or to fit a system of religion into his gospel not only corrupts the gospel and nullifies it of its power, but actively condemns the one who does such a thing. And so we live in a day of pluralistic, subjective messages. Your truth is your truth. My truth is my truth. There are many ways to God, and so as long as we just love each other and respect everyone's views and respect everyone's religion and practice tolerance and don't condemn anyone's way of life, then that's all that Jesus really wanted. What a lie. This is a passage that overtly rejects such sentimental, superficial statements. Even within religion or within the church, there is so much talk about these days on things like the love of God. You just got to love people, love your neighbor, seek to be a good person, do good things. This is what Jesus did, and so we should just try our best to be a good person and love other people. But the point of the passage is to say that the message of Jesus, in other words, the message of the gospel, is a very exclusive message that is incredibly objective, must be believed, and requires all true believers to reject syncretism. It is to reject the idea that we can somehow patch together religions and truths and ideas and ideologies and definitions of love and different versions of Jesus, and then assume that in the end it'll somehow save everybody because Jesus just wants you to be a nice person. And as long as you're sincere or genuine, God will save you. But we have to get the objective truth of the gospel right. And you know this. We have to understand that salvation does not come through any human effort, through random versions of Jesus, but through the objective, revealed work of Jesus Christ alone, as we see it in the Word. This has nothing to do with what we can do for Jesus through our religion, through our acts of love toward other people, but everything to do with what Jesus Christ has done for us. Yes. And so the moment that we seek to add to his finished work, and it is finished. This is what he cried out on the cross, right? It is finished. And so the moment that we seek to add to that, we corrupt the very salvation that he has already accomplished. This is what he means by new wine being spilled out. You cannot pour the gospel into a religious system. And yet Jesus knew that many would reject this. Human beings are so prone to religion because we're so prone to thinking that we can solve our own problems, that we can solve our own sin or show ourselves to be a pretty good person. In fact, this is why all throughout the history of the world, human beings have been so deeply entrenched in religious activity. Just pick your religion, doesn't really matter, but every single one of them is a system in which people try to somehow please God and earn his favor. And so you have to do stuff, a lot of stuff. And keep doing stuff, repetitive stuff, to try and make him somehow more happy with you. And yet it is up and against that reality that makes the gospel so unique, the true gospel. It is the only message in all of the world, in all the religions of the world, that state that people cannot do anything to please God or to fix this problem of their sin because he has completely done it for us in our place. And he did it decisively, he did it finally in his death and in his resurrection. He executed his just wrath for sin in his son as he hung on the cross so that he gets our punishment and we get his perfect righteousness. This is something called the Great Exchange. A sinner is saved by the grace and the mercy of God, and yet God remains 100% just in the righteous punishment of sin, but as he poured out his wrath upon his son and in our place. And to which, again, the only appropriate response is faith, that is, trust in that message. That's all that faith means. Faith is a fancy word. It just means trust. Is trust in a message, trust in a promise that Jesus can and does forgive sin. It is not faith in iconoclasm. It is not faith in sacramentalism. It is not faith in Sabbatarianism or sacrificialism, but faith and faith alone in the saving work of Jesus Christ alone. And yet Jesus, knowing that many would reject this message, and perhaps because it's just too easy to believe, because again, all that he's asking us to do is believe. That is to trust by faith in the gospel that he has absorbed and appeased all of God's eternal wrath on the cross. And so there's nothing we can do. He's done it for us. And so we simply need to embrace that promise of forgiveness of sin by faith alone. That is all that is required of the sinner. But Jesus knew that many would reject this. In fact, notice he ends here in verse 39 with these words, with this third and final parable. He says, and no one, mark that, no one, after drinking old wine, wishes for new. This is so sad. No one, after drinking old wine, wishes for new. Why? For he says the old is good enough. The old is good enough. In other words, there will be many who hear the gospel message, which is what I just gave to you. That is, there will be many who hear that salvation comes by faith alone, through the work of Jesus Christ alone, and yet as they hear that gospel, they'll simply reject it. And why? Well, because frankly, they're completely satisfied and yet entirely deceived within their old system of religion. And so they'll have no taste for truth, no appetite for the true gospel. And so in the context, he's saying that once a person is trapped within a false system of religion, it will be very difficult for them to develop any kind of taste for truth. And many of you understand this. Many of you have friends and family who are trapped within some kind of system of religion. And yet as you speak with them and you talk with them, one, they either reject what you're saying because they've already concluded that their old system is good enough, which is exactly what Jesus said that they'll say. Or two, they'll have no taste for truth. And so they can't even discern the difference between what you're saying that they must believe and what they're truly believing. They can't discern. Because they have been so deceived by the false system that they cannot see it. And so it becomes a very difficult thing. In fact, I was talking to a person earlier this week, and I told him that the devil and his minions always, almost always attack at the point of truth. That's just how he works. It is not some kind of Hollywood thing where heads are spinning and pea soup is flying out. That is not how the devil and his minions work. Rather, his attacks are almost always aimed at the point of truth. Which is why no wonder that all throughout the millennia, his greatest scheme has always been to trap and imprison people within a false system of religion, where many have been deceived by a demonic lie that presents itself as truth. And because he is a messenger of light disguised. And so make no mistake, the religion and self-righteous approaches to try and please God through human effort has been perhaps the greatest scheme of the devil. Men trying to please God and earn his grace through religious good works. It is deadly. And so he ends on a sad note here. He ends on a very sad note, and we're out of time, but I think that it's a very helpful message, a very helpful passage, because in a day in which tolerance and syncretism are praised and applauded by the culture and even within many religions and evangelical churches, what Jesus is saying is that his message is unbelievably incompatible with any other message. Yet, at the same time, it is a message of pure grace. Pure grace. This is a message that salvation is possible for the sinner. In fact, it's what makes his message so different. It is not a message of salvation through religious law-keeping and works-based righteousness. Rather, this is a message of grace. That salvation has come, and not because of anything that we have done. This is what grace means. This is a gift, undeserved, unmerited, unearned. And it is exactly what Jesus offers to the worst of sinner, if we would believe. And so the message of the gospel is a message in which it is profoundly, listen, this is what's so good about it. It is a message in which it is profoundly okay to admit your guilt and sin and depravity. And again, why? Well, because Jesus has not come to call the righteous, that is the good people, but who? The sinner. The worst of sinners. And so as time grows increasingly dark for the church, especially within this nation, the purity, I think, of the gospel can shine now even brighter. We do not need to be ashamed for preaching an exclusive message in a time in which inclusivism is praised. We do not need to shy away or try and patch the gospel onto religion or make other religions compromise to better fit the gospel. Rather, we preach something entirely different, entirely new, and that is the true gospel of Jesus Christ alone. And why? Well, for as Paul says, it is the power unto salvation. It is the only power unto salvation. And so if we don't preach a pure gospel message, then we corrupt its power to save. And so my final thought here, very quickly, is that Jesus never calls us to do anything that he himself has not already endured, right? He faced the oppositions, he faced the accusations, He faced the indictments from the religious institution when he called people to follow him as Lord, and yet never once did he ever compromise his message. He never compromised or sought to somehow make it compatible or perhaps a little more palatable with an existing religion or declaration of what was being called truth. And so as followers of Jesus, what is our task? What is our calling? Well, we cannot and must not ever attempt to patch Jesus onto religion, nor can we patch another religion onto Jesus, but we must declare the message of Jesus as something completely different, completely new, unique, set apart. And so, brothers and sisters, may we never compromise the purity of the gospel message. Our task as a church and followers of Jesus is to bring forth that very same message that Jesus himself wrought. And yet as we do, God will use it to save sinners. And why? Well, again, for it is the power unto salvation for all who believe. And so we do not apologize. We do not compromise. Rather, we pray, we preach, we plead. And then we let the purity of the gospel alone do that transformative work that God has designed it to do. And that is our calling, and that is our tremendous privilege and task. Let's pray. And so, Father, I do pray that this would be a cause for reflection for us. I hope in my prayers that this word which you've given to us in your providence this morning might not leave us unchanged, but that it would cause us by the power of your Spirit to better understand just the vastness of your love to save sinners. That we might understand in a fuller way your compassion and your grace toward the sinner. For you know that there is nothing that we can do, and so you did it for us. You did it in the sending forth of your Son to bear our guilt upon his cross. You sent forth your Son to take on flesh, to take on the weakness of what it means to be a man. And so that you might enter this world, live a perfect life, die in our place, rise again, but to rescue us from the grip of our own self-destruction. So may we come, may we bow down at the foot of your cross. May we find rest, true rest in knowing that you are a God who loves to save sinners. And so I ask that you impress this truth upon us this morning. I ask that you would establish it in our minds now as we sing, that you would seal it within our hearts, that we might have a hope, and that we might find an everlasting comfort by faith in you alone. And so I do ask these things for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.